and uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina. Beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on RadioBar.org and White Rose Society. Well, in the last 24 hours, an estimated 58,000 people in the world have died from lack of food and or water, including one in Florida, a well-celebrated case. Here in the United States, in 2003, 11.2% of all U.S. households were what the U.S. Department of Agriculture refers to as food insecure. To quote from their website, it is defined as the uneasy or painful sensation caused by lack of food. Now, people don't have food available to them in the United States. Of the 12.6 million households who were food insecure last year, 3.9 million suffered from food insecurity that was so severe that the USDA's very conservative measure classified them as hungry. 12.6 million literally don't know where their next meal is coming from. Since 1999, food insecurity has increased by 2.1 million households. This is in the United States, including 1.1 million households with children. In 2003, 36.3 million people lived in households experiencing food insecurity, compared with 33.6 million in 2001 and only 31 million in 1999. Pretty strange. I think it's useful to put these things into context. 65% of agencies servicing those in the United States who are hungry reported increased requests for emergency shelter services in the last 3 years. 77% said, and this in the study in the last year, that due to inadequate resources, they had been forced to turn people away. Despite increasing requests for emergency food and shelter, 43% of 900 agencies surveyed in 32 states, 43% said they received less state funding last year, 35% reported that their federal funding had been cut, and that was before the Bush budget came out. The Bush budget, of course, proposing to cut $1 billion out of the food stamp program over the next 10 years, meaning 200,000 to 300,000 fewer low-income individuals will receive nutrition assistance. The budget proposes to eliminate funding for the Community Food and Nutrition Program. It also cuts the Commodity Supplemental Food Program by $3 million, which would mean a drop in caseload of 45,000 people. Is hunger a moral issue? 1-866-889-8894, by the way, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, our website if you want to drop by. And, hey, Ira, you got to remind Louise to flip off the fax machine. I had turned it on a little earlier. So the U.S. Fish – yesterday we were talking about the outrages in the – they have now put in charge of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the agency that authorizes or that issues permits – to allow big game hunters to bring endangered species that they have hunted overseas, often illegally, into the United States. You know, bring their trophies back, and that the guy who, and this is the agency that issues these licenses, that the guy who's the head of this now under Bush is the chief lobbyist for a bunch of big game hunters. Well, the plot thickens. Hear this today, the U.S. News service here. This is a press release from the Protect Wild Life Pure News. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service orders its biologists to approve all development projects in South Florida, regardless of the consequences to wildlife, according to a letter by 20 current and former agency scientists released today by Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. That's PEER, the group responsible for this news release. The biologists also write that a key supervisor in the FWS Vero Beach office, the Fish and Wildlife Service Vero Beach office, called the Florida panther a zoo species and forbade scientific staff from raising concerns about threatened or endangered species. In other words, we are the Fish and Wildlife Service. We're supposed to protect endangered species. But here in Florida, forget it. This from 20 current and former agency scientists working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Florida. Last month, PIER and the Union of Concerned Scientists released a survey of FWS Fish and Wildlife Service scientists from across the nation that found high levels of political manipulation of agency science. Gee, what a surprise. I am truly astounded, aren't you? I'm sure you must be. In that survey, FWS scientists based in Florida reported some of the highest levels of political interference in the nation. Bush World. I mean, it's the Banana Republic, formerly known as the United States, and now known as Bush World. Welcome to our program. Greetings to the folks in the chat room. Good to see you all there. If you hear noise in the background, we are packing up and shipping out. Louise and I are in 2 weeks, actually a week from tomorrow. We're going to move out to the West Coast, out to Portland, Oregon, and we will be doing the program. We will be doing this program from Oregon instead of from Vermont, although there will still be a good chunk of Vermont in it, and Bernie Sanders will continue to be a regular guest on our program. So just a tip, nothing's going to change on your end. You're going to hear the same program. We're moving to Portland. Our youngest daughter has lived there for 3 years. My mother-in-law, brother-in-law, and his wife moved to Oregon about 4 months ago, and so we're joining the cavalcade. Today in the Wall Street Journal, an interesting op-ed piece by Thea Lee, who is the chief international economist at the AFL-CIO. I find this particularly interesting, it being on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, which is typically a fairly toxic place. But they gave the AFL-CIO a chance to speak their mind. No doubt there will be a rebuttal of sorts tomorrow, and probably multiple ones. And it's about CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, which is the follow-up on NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. The NAFTA Free Trade Agreement, of course, pushed through by Bill Clinton and Bob Dole. You might say a bipartisan effort. The NAFTA agreement was the first surrender of national sovereignty. CAFTA makes it even bigger. NAFTA just is the United States, Mexico, and Canada. CAFTA takes us all the way down to Panama, all the way, the whole of the United States. And Thea Lee notes, in this op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal today, since NAFTA was implemented, our trade deficit with Canada and Mexico has increased 1,200% from $9 billion in 1993 to $111 billion in 2004. That's pretty amazing. This is not raw imports and exports. This is the difference between the two. The trade deficit, the amount that we're having essentially to borrow from somebody in order to buy all this stuff from Canada and Mexico, since NAFTA was instituted, has increased 1,200%. It was the deficit. It was $9 billion in 1993, and today it is now $11 billion in 2004. Well, most recent numbers last year. And the result of this: over 1 million decent-paying jobs have been displaced here at home. As industries, writes Thea Lee, as industries as diverse as aircraft, autos, apparel, and consumer electronics are, essentially, you could say they're wiped out. I found it particularly interesting. I was, where was it I saw it? It must have been in the store. Jack Welch on the cover of Time or Newsweek or Businessweek or one of those magazines this week. You know, Jack Welch is a great turnaround guy for GE. He's a wonderful, all the work he did, and he's a billionaire because he earned it. Blah, blah, blah. And I was just amazed, the timing of this thing. It's almost like the folks at the Wall Street Journal have an exaggerated sense of irony. Because this thing must have been in the planning for a while, and they must have just released it a few days ago. And then we find, rather unambiguously, this article, which I shared with you earlier in the week, I believe it was Monday or Tuesday of this week from the Wall Street Journal, about how Jack Welch went over to India, and he went over there to sell General Electric stuff. This was early in his tenure, some 15 years ago, more or less. Early 90s, he goes over to India to sell GE stuff, and the Indians say to him, "Hey, we can make stuff here. We can make it a lot cheaper than in the United States. Why doesn't GE start sending their jobs over here After all, you know, you guys don't care if Americans have jobs. It's just, you know, and you can make more money. You know, you pay less money here in India, they said. And so Jack Welch did that, and GE became the first big major outsourcer of American jobs, American industry, to India anyway, and built this this modern day explosion that's happening in India. I mean, you can thank Jack Welch for all this. And I wonder, you know, I didn't pick up the magazine and read it. At some point, perhaps this weekend, I'll have the time to. But I wonder if they will even mention that. My guess is they won't even come close. That would be my guess. They won't even come close. At the same time, Thea Lee in the Wall Street Journal notes, Rico have fallen. Now, this is interesting. I saw Vicente Fox on Lou Dobbs the other night, and he was saying, oh, we've seen an increase in wages and a decrease in poverty since NAFTA in Mexico. Well, it's interesting. When you look at their major industries, their three major industries are the export of oil, the export of illegal drugs, and tourism. Well, let's take the top four. Tourism and the importing of wealth from Mexican citizens, roughly 10% of the country of Mexico, living illegally in the United States and sending home checks. These are their four major sources of income. So, maybe there are more folks sending money back to Mexico. But in any case, here from this article in the Wall Street Journal, it points, Thea Lee points out, at the same time, real wages in Mexico have fallen, and the number of poor people has grown, and illegal immigration flows have doubled. That's into the United States. Trade liberalization in agriculture displaced nearly a million small rural farmers. This and the consequence of this is tremendous. I mean, this is where you have a situation where people would normally be able to live on their farm, feed themselves, feed their families, and have enough left over to go to the market and sell it. And they've been doing this for thousands and thousands of years. And we open up the borders we produce mind-boggling amounts of corn here in the United States, heavily subsidized. Huge amounts of corn being shipped down to Mexico to be sold. And these, you know, poor local farmers, they can't compete. They can't compete with American agriculture. They can't compete with tractors and pesticides and herbicides. And mostly they can't compete with the billions of dollars in subsidies that we provide to agriculture every year in the United States. So what do? They close up shop. They stop farming. And they end up living in the slums of Mexico City. Or they end up coming across the border to the United States to clean pools in Los Angeles. And it's a tragedy. It's our trade policies are increasing poverty in the United States and in Mexico. And now they want to extend this all the way down to Central America. 20 minutes after the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lindball.
This is the old Brush.
888-242-8272.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The Psycho Cowboy, yippee-yi, whoopee-whoopee-tie, whoopee-whoopee-tie, don't you? Don't run, run away.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman program where democracy will not be downsized. Although they're working on it, I'll tell you out there, this whole thing, the WTO, Thea Lee again from the AFL-CIO in today's Wall Street Journal, is just a remarkable op-ed piece, really well worth reading. She points out the WTO with regard to China. 10 years into the WTO, our trade deficit is at a record-smashing $617 billion, close to an unsustainable 6% of GDP. Now, you think about it, at 6%, if there's any compounding in that, it seems that within about 11 or 12 years, you would no longer own any of your country whatsoever. I mean, when you think about the math on this, a $617 billion trade deficit, that is $617 billion that we have to borrow from someplace, mostly from China, Saudi Arabia, Japan, South Korea. that we have to borrow from others in order to buy all the stuff we're buying, in order to fill our Walmarts, as it were, and importing from China, and the Michael Dell and his computers and whatnot, all that stuff. And at some point they can say to us, you know, the bill is due. You guys have to pay. It's time for you guys to pay the bill on these things. We would like something in exchange for this. And in fact, they're actually right now fairly aggressively taking things in exchange for it. We find increasingly that American businesses are being owned by offshore companies, overseas companies, which means the profit's no longer staying here in the United States. You know, it's nice if they create jobs and all that, but the profit's not staying here in the United States any longer. And the result of that, the result of that, of course, is a further, increase in poverty in the United States, period. I mean, it's great for multinational corporations. It's lousy for workers and for average Americans. CAFTA, Thea Lee notes, extends a failed model. She says we should all understand by now that modern, that's post-NAFTA, free trade agreements are not just about lowering tariffs. They're about changing the conditions attached to trade liberalization in ways that benefit some players and hurt others. This is people, it's like, it's free trade. It's wonderful. It's just the marketplace will decide. No, I'm sorry. It's not. First of all, it's not free trade. The GATT agreements are 10 books that are each about 3 inches thick. I mean, the rules of trade under the World Trade Organization will come up to your chest if you just, stack them up from the floor. No, it's not about free trade. It's about organizing trade in a way that benefits multinational corporations, period. And, in fact, she goes on to say in today's Wall Street Journal, these are finely orchestrated special interest deals that boost the profits and power of multinational corporations, leaving workers, family farmers, and many small businesses and the environment more vulnerable than ever. Now, she also goes on to point out that Americans are not unaware of this. 74% of Americans oppose CAFTA, the extension of this free trade agreement all the way down into Central America. And a fine 74% that is. And in addition, she points out, in Central America, tens of thousands of workers, farmers, small business owners, and other activists have taken to the streets. And they don't want this happening in Central America either. They don't want our American corn coming down there, wiping out small farmers and increasing poverty in Central America. And just like we shouldn't be wanting our textile industries and our other labor-intensive industries to simply be moving to Panama or to other Central American countries, just because nobody in the United States, because suddenly people, individuals, workers in the United States are having to compete, not with other Americans or other people here in the United States, they're having to compete with labor in El Salvador, where people will work for 50 cents an hour, a dollar an hour. And you can, of course, live cheaper there, too. So this is the argument for keeping local economies local. In any case, she points out, CAFTA strengthens protections for multinational corporations, forcing draconian changes in intellectual property protection rights, giving corporations new rights to sue governments over regulations that seem too costly or inconvenient. It's a mess. It's an absolute mess. 29 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman with you, helping you win the water cooler wars.
Live in poverty.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I've been second-guessed by the best of them.
Bow, bow.
Left for dead by the rest of them.
Bow, bow, bow.
But I'm a good man,
bow.
A strong man,
bow.
Live by a good plan.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 27 and a half minutes, 26 and a half minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And I just want to wrap this thing up with CAFTA and then move along, because it's just so much in the news today and so much this relevant to these bizarre situations here. CAFTA, this again, Thea Lee, she says CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, strengthens protections for multinational corporations, giving corporations new rights to sue governments over regulations that they deem too costly or inconvenient. You get this? This is what, prior to NAFTA and GATT and the World Trade Organization and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, a corporation did not have the right to sue a government. They, you know, governments were sovereign. A government is we the people. It's us. And nobody said, hey, you know, if a corporation can sue we the people in a foreign country over trade policy. I mean, of course, you can sue any government agency if you think that they've done something wrong. But I mean, this whole point of multinationals being able to say, okay, your trade policy says I can't sell my product. And now that not only can they sue, but they can claim loss of profits as well. It puts corporations at the same level, multinational corporations at the same level as governments. And this agreement is also going to limit the ability of future legislators to place conditions on government procurement. In other words, we're going to enter into an agreement. Treaties supersede domestic law, you realize. The Constitution says if you sign a treaty and there are domestic laws that conflict with it, those laws have to go. We're going to sign a treaty that is going to say that our legislators, that the United States Senate, the United States House of Representatives, individual state legislatures, can no longer pass particular types of laws that will, in particular types of ways, protect particular types of American or human institutions. Incredible. Mind-boggling. As Guatemalan Bishop Monsignor Alvaro Ramazzini, here we go, it breaks in the line, Ramazzini, said on March 10th, he said, CAFTA is much more than a simple free trade agreement. It includes a range of mechanisms that combine prohibitions on governments with rights for foreign investors on such issues as investment, national treatment, intellectual property rights, market access, public services, and access to bidding on public contracts. If implemented, CAFTA will transfer privileges for corporations into rights for corporations. And there, you know, there's a substantial and growing move across the United States to say, and actually around the world, to say, hey, wait a minute, we don't think corporations should have rights. We think that the rights should be held by individual people. Corporations should have privileges. Just like governments don't have rights, they have privileges. Nonprofits don't have rights, they have privileges. Why are we giving rights to corporations? This is just over the top here. And now you've got American unions, Central American unions, coming together, says Thea Lee of the AFL-CIO, coming together to oppose CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, which will be before Congress, you know, coming to a theater near you soon, right? That sort of thing. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Let's go to the phones. Rodney in Houston, Texas on the line. Hey, Rodney, what's up?
How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Rodney?
I just want to talk about the Social Security, the privatization of Social Security, and what that means.
Okay, we're gonna actually get into that fairly heavily in the second hour, although we can talk about it right now, but we're going to have a guest on who's going to tell us, she's a conservative, she's going to tell us how wonderful everything will be if we just privatize Social Security and
it'll be.
That's right, and hand our future over to the corporations. Everything will be
fine. That right there for me is the move to complete fascism.
Yeah, I don't. You're using my word, Rodney. You're right there.
And you know, I mean, it's no wonder that, you know, that like in China, that they have huge buildings where they're just stockholding, piling at the American dollar.
Yeah.
I mean, our money is losing.
Well, they're stockpiling.
Are you familiar with LaRouche?
Yeah, I am, and that's a whole other topic. Let's not get into it. But I'm familiar with the Chinese hoarding dollars. They're doing it because they have to. Basically, they have to take our dollars if they want to keep selling us, you know, junk for Walmart and computers parts for, you know, various computer companies. IBM now is selling out to Chinese, and they're stuck with all these dollars. Well, not quite stuck, because they can use them to buy oil, because oil is denominated in dollars, and so thus
right, the value of our American dollar is depreciating. So I mean, we're headed towards the worst depression that the world that we've ever seen.
I am of the opinion that you may well be right. I certainly hope you're wrong, but I have a strong and sneaking suspicion that you are right. At least perhaps here in the United States, there are some countries that will probably weather it fairly well. But the 25 years of Reaganomics have just devastated the economic infrastructure and the economic strength of this country. Devastated.
And the economic hitmen that go, I mean, we're we go like what we did in China, basically. You know, we told them that they needed an infrastructure, showed them how to do it, and then we basically go over there and destroy their economy.
Yeah, well, and we give them all this stuff. Rodney, got to move along. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Alan, South Carolina on the line. Hey, Alan.
Yeah, I remember one time at one of the presidential, vice presidential debates.
Uh-huh.
That Dan Quayle bragged that we were making Honda. Honda had a plant here in the United States, and we were making Honda automobiles and sending them back to Japan.
Yeah, I remember him bragging about that and thinking that's pretty strange. The strangest thing about it is that Dan Quayle never figured out that when Honda makes cars in the United States, the profits go back to Japan. And the only reason companies do things like making cars is to make a profit. Alan, your cell phone's breaking up there. I think you're out of range, so I'm gonna drop you. If you get a little solid or signal, you can give us a shout back. Joe and Barrett. That was Alan's line. Joe, so you know we have a free line. Hey, Joe in Barranco, Ohio, you're live on the Tom Hartman program. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you, bud?
I'm great. What's up?
Well, you are, and you're a great guy. You really are a big help. We're working on a solution to this. It's called, I talked to you back a while ago. I ran for U.S. Senate as a Being Human Party candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason, and I'd really like to have a chance to kind of roll this around with you sometime off air, if you're up for it, because basically, the Being Human Party, the focus of it is that human beings only, no corporations or special interests allowed. And two, we only accept $200 maximum campaign donations from human beings in any candidacy. Only $100 maximum for membership. You can't put any more than that in, so nobody has ownership above anybody else.
Right.
And we promote all the other party candidates, regardless of what they are, if they meet the following criteria. One, they're promoting world peace. Two, they accept no campaign donations from corporations or special interests. And three, they cap at $200.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, Joe, you have a lot of great suggestions there. You're really not that far off from where Teddy Roosevelt was when he was running on the Bull Moose Party platform.
Right.
And you know, going back to the roots of the Republican Roosevelt. So it's good American stuff. I salute you and I encourage you and I wish the best for you. Good luck on it. Julie in Madison, Wisconsin on the line. Hey, Julie, what's on your mind today?
Yes, hi, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
Hey, I want your opinion on Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela.
Yes.
And what would happen if they decided to stop trading in dollars for their oil and went to the euro?
We would be in deep trouble. Yeah, we would be in very deep trouble. And Chavez is actually talking about doing that, and he's trying to create strategic alliances with other countries that might protect him or might help him in the event that we were to go after him. And he's buying military hardware and whatnot. I mean, he's getting ready. He says, you know, he's already been the victim of one coup attempt by the Bush administration, and he says that, you know, they're trying to kill him, they're trying to throw him out. Now, Chavez himself is not the most gentle of gentlemen, as they would say. I mean, you know, he's got a lot of rough edges, and I'm not here to say that he's the very best head of state Venezuela has ever had, but he is the elected leader of the country.
Didn't he also do land reparations?
Oh yeah, this is the thing that has the right wingers in Venezuela just absolutely flipped out. The two things: number one, he's nationalized the oil industry, and a lot of the profit from the oil, of Venezuelan oil, is going to help the people of Venezuela. Number two, he broke up some of the oligarchic structure, some of the old families that would own hundreds of thousands, millions of acres, and redistributed some of that land. And these things are viewed by folks in the Bush administration as communist. You know, this is socialist. This is horrible. We can't have this. But they were willing to put up with that. I mean, this is nothing compared to what Musharraf does in Pakistan, you know, in terms of whatever you want to call it. You know, but we'll put up with him as long as he's our ally. But Chavez holds so much power over us because of the oil that Venezuela has. I believe they are either the fourth or the fifth largest. They own either the fourth or fifth largest reserves of oil on the planet.
Yeah, I believe the fourth.
Yeah, and
it seems like democracy is on the march down in Venezuela, if you were to ask me personally.
Yeah, and my prediction is that before 2008, we're gonna take a whack at him. because this administration is all about getting oil.
Well, that in Cuba, because they found oil off the shores of Cuba as well. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Hopefully, on it goes, huh? On
American
it goes.
People will wake up.
Let us hope so, Julie.
It will happen.
Let us hope so. Julie, thanks for the call. It's great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Josh in South Florida on the line. Hey, Josh.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Good. Man, I love your show, and you and I are in agreement on a lot of different things, and I think that we've actually emailed back and forth before. I have my experience when I was a little younger and a lot less informed with the Halliburton of the maritime services world, in which I was a management trainee.
Mm-hmm.
I was sent to Mexico by this corporation, a huge corporation, sent to Mexico smuggling boat parts across the border.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an M16 in my back, an AR-15 in my back, and I started to question what was really going on down there.
Yeah.
And it's illegal to do that. And I was younger and badly informed and manipulated. Well, when I got there, I had a meeting with some of the jefes from Pemex, the chiefs, and these guys at Pemex were.
Pemex is the Mexican oil company, right?
Yeah. It's a vast company with state-run people, and that the way it is, it's a franchise. Like if you're a Mexican citizen and your relatives or your husband or wife works for Pemex, you can have someone else work for you and you just declare a portion of the profit.
Right.
And when I got down there, I was shocked to realize that although I had had some rough experience in the American Gulf of Mexico oil business, Pemex doesn't do lost time accidents. They write them off as suicides.
Right.
And when I was there, I met the guy named his nickname is El Matador, the killer, and he's a supervisor for their barge work. And it's daily down there. You know, Ciudad del Carmen in Mexico is the site of the largest oil spill in history of the world.
Yeah. Josh, I have to ask you to get to the point.
My point is that no one cares right now about anything but the short-term, bottom-line, quick-buck profits. And nonetheless, that company I was working for, it's a matter of long-term view versus short-term view, and short-term profits, as long as they sell stock and make people money, rich people money, they will never yield to the environment, to human rights.
Oh, sure, and they'll never be a problem, and we'll never be calling them terrorists like we are now. All of a sudden, in fact, on the news last night, I saw Hugo Chavez referred to as a man who was involved with terrorism. First time I'd actually heard that. I mean, maybe it's been out there for a while and I just missed it. Rich, thanks for your call, Josh. Rich in Chicago on the line. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, Tom, love listening to the program, by the way.
Thank
But you know, sometimes I listen to you and you spew all the facts and the figures and they're right on, like our deficit and our debt and these things these people are doing. And I start getting panicky. You know, what's a little advice or a bright side for the average middle class American that if this system falls apart, what's the best way that we could insulate ourselves? You know, are we going to go back to a system where, you know, it's going to be community and you better have the victory garden in the back and we're all going to take care of each other and we're not going to drive? Or is it a doomsday scenario?
It's either.
What's the way out?
It's, Josh, Rich.
I'm going to hang out and listen to your answer.
Okay, fine, thanks. It's either going to be that. I mean, that's one option. One option is for us to move in the direction of alternative sources of energy, start, you know, victory, start growing your own vegetables in your backyard, as we did in this country. Following the advice of Jimmy Carter from 3 decades ago and moving into alternative sources of energy, which is happening. And we could have a relatively soft landing and reinstating trade policies that are rational, that bring industry back into the United States so that we start making in the United States once again the things we use. We don't even make blue jeans in the United States anymore. Levi Strauss just closed their last factory. I mean, if we can reverse those things and we can do it fairly quickly, then we might have a soft landing. If not, it's going to be a hard landing, and it's going to hit hardest those people who have a lot of debt. And this is why I think this bankruptcy bill is pushing through, because they see it coming and they're getting ready for it. They want to be able to create basically perpetual debt for people rather than give people the opportunity to wipe the slate clean and start over. We've always encouraged risk in the United States. That's why we have the bankruptcy laws. We want people to take chances. We want them to start businesses. We want them to strike out on their own. This is what built this country, people taking risks. And we want to say, hey, and if you take a risk and it doesn't work out, you know, it's not going to be the end of your life. It might be the end of your credit for a few years, but it's not going to be the end of your life. You're not going to be a debt slave forever. And the conservatives, the Republicans, they want to change that. And so anyway, I mean, there's this whole spectrum of what should we do out there. In my opinion, we still have time if we can get good, progressive, knowledgeable, people who understand this stuff people who can read Paul Krugman and it makes sense to him to them, into our state and federal legislatures. I still think it's possible. I still think we have time. And the 2006 elections are going to be absolutely pivotal. Patrick in Orlando, Florida on the line. Hey, Patrick, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Love your program.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, like that last caller from Chicago, is there anything else we can do? I'm in the construction industry. I'm getting overrun by illegal labor. And I was wondering, if when you guys move up to Portland, do you have any job openings or anything like that? How can we insulate ourselves against the falling dollar and what the Great Depression might bring if it does come back?
Put the short answer, Patrick, is put your money into real assets. Yeah, get either out of debt as much as you can, or totally into debt as much as you can. One or the other, you know, preparing for a worst case scenario, but to the extent that you can pay off your car, you can pay off your home, whatever, or you know, buy real assets. Those are the things.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So long, honey dear, where I'm bound, I can't tell.
It's sort of the state of the country. Again, not offering financial advice or anything of the type here, but I know there are people out there running around saying, you know, buy gold or whatever. It seems to me like the best... We're at the peak of the bubble for the housing market. So if somebody was so inclined, it would be a good time. Excuse me. It would be a good time to sell their home and rent for a while, as housing prices, in my estimation, my guess is, over the next year or two, are probably going to cut in half in a good chunk of America. And we're seeing that bubble bursting. It's at the edge of it. A good time to make sure that you've got a good garden. And a good time to build community. I think social capital is probably the most important thing. Getting involved with whether it's church or clubs or synagogue or family or the bowling league or whatever. Building social capital, building community. The ability of people helping out each other to help out each other. That's just what it's going to take. John in New York's on the line. Hey, John, what's up? Oh,
touch on something you said before about bringing things to be made in the U.S. How about we start with the flag?
Yeah. We should pass a law. I mean, all those flags that they were waving in Congress when George W. was inaugurated, you know, that were made in China. Many of them were made in China.
You got to be kidding.
No. Several people, you know, called into the program and said, you know, I've got one of these flags made in China. Our local hardware store the other day, I was walking by, they had flags for sale out in front, made in China.
I went to the protest 2 weeks ago on the 19th. There was a vendor there selling upside down flags.
Yeah.
He didn't even know they were made in Taiwan. I had to bring it to his attention. He's like, I didn't know that, or I wouldn't have bought it. I told him, don't feel bad. Your government's the one that sold us out, not you.
That's right. And odds are he couldn't have bought it anyplace else because there's probably not anybody else in the United States making them except for, you know, a few eccentric companies who have large orders from, you know, specific groups who only want Made in America flags. So it's an amazing state of affairs, John. John, I appreciate it. Robert in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Robert, you got the last word. We got about 20 seconds.
Hey, Tom. I live in D.C., and every once in a while I get these handouts from Linda LaRouche people.
Yeah.
I was just wondering exactly who he is and what his history is.
You know, I don't know. I'm not an expert on Lyndon LaRouche. I understand that he's running around saying the Holocaust never happened, and that's enough to cause me to not pay much attention to anything else he says. So I just can tell you, I don't know. That's the bottom line.
Thanks
a lot, Robert. Good to hear from you. And I'm sure that'll stir it up because, you know, maybe I'm wrong on that. I don't know. I'm sure we'll find out. Anyhow, we're transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Been listening to the Tom Hartman Program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, Live365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, archives there, and at TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our chat room, well-populated by some of the finest and most erudite minds on the entire Earth. Not just on the internet. Well, a lot of discussion these days about Social Security and the privatization thereof and all that sort of thing. What's going on with this? And so I wanted to get on Lisa DePasquale. She is the program director of the Clara Booth Luce Policy Institute in Herndon, Virginia. She's also the co-owner of Heat Bags. If you are a woman and you want to carry a gun, heatbags.com. And she's the managing editor of The Right Report, therightreport.com. Lisa is an outspoken, from her bio here, an outspoken adversary of the left and radical feminism and a proponent of modern conservative principles, including privatization of Social Security, a small streamlined federal government, welfare reform, and freedom of speech on college campuses. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
I'm pleased to have you on. Now, tell us, speaking specifically of Social Security, what is it that you think should be done with Social Security?
Well, I think that we need to go to a system that would allow people to have control over a percentage, in a perfect world it would be all of it, but, you know, at the very least a percentage of the current 12.4 payroll tax that's taken out and put into Social Security that, you know, pays, it's in and out, it pays for the retirees now, but at least to get the opportunity for people to, you know, create wealth for themselves, because a lot of people that will rely on Social Security do not have the disposable income to, you know, save beyond that, because Social Security is not guaranteed, says the Supreme Court. Just because you pay into the system doesn't mean it's a contractual right to receive benefits.
Well, yeah, the government can change their programs anytime they want, and regularly do. But what you're talking about, the ability to put money into a specific program, I mean, isn't that what a 401k is, or a SEPA, or an IRA?
That's easy to tell people that, you know, perhaps work minimum wage jobs, where they don't have it. For instance, I work at a nonprofit. We don't have a 401k. We don't have any sort of, pension or 401k available. So it's pretty much relies on whether I put money aside or if the 12% that is taken out of the payroll tax for Social Security, if I could at least have control over 4% of that, just because at the age that I am and if Social Security continues on the same track, I will get a negative 0.8% return. So I won't even get the money that I've paid into the system. So by allowing control of the 4%,
I get your point.
It would have a greater return.
Yeah, but your negative return, more than half of Social Security recipients over the age of 65 now, in fact, more than 70% of Social Security recipients over the age of 75 are women who essentially didn't pay into the system. Most of them are getting survivor's benefits. And, you know, if in order to provide for these private accounts that you're suggesting, we had to cut benefits, what happens to people like that?
Well, I mean, that's hard, and that's why I think the personal retirement accounts are part of it, because even if the remaining 8% was cut, because you're getting a higher return of the 4%, it would still cover it.
But these women never paid anything into it. Mm-hmm. They were housewives.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just kind of one of the benefits of being a stay-at-home mom, and I guess also that women, you know, live longer than men, that they are allowed to collect. And I mean,
right. So,
I think
so
it's
they're not going to have private accounts. We have a situation in the United States right now where the senior poverty level, the poverty among people over 65, is running around 11.9%. If you were to take away Social Security, it would be over 47%.
Yeah, no, I mean, no one's talking about taking away Social Security, and actually the ability to have a private account wouldn't apply to anyone over 55. Because there's so much more money going into the system right now for people that aren't collecting, like African Americans, a majority of them aren't able to collect what they pay in because their average lifespan is 67 and aren't able to even to collect at all sometimes.
Actually,
you can't collect till 67.
Actually, Lisa, I think you've been listening to some nonsense from somebody. Those statistics when they first trotted those things out, you know, everybody was like, what? And they went back and looked at it. And the reason for that is because African American infant mortality is higher. Mm-hmm. That's the main thing that drags down the lifespan. More of them.
Well, that's what I said. I mean, it is average.
They're not surviving childhood, and that should be, I think, a problem that we should all look at and say, hey, let's do something about this. But you know, the reality is that African Americans are getting their money back out of Social Security just pretty much like everybody else does. But here's the problem that I have. This whole private account thing, you know, it all sounds well and good, but it not only does absolutely nothing for the solvency problem, the fact that, you know, this bulge of money that we started accumulating in 1982 so that we would have money to pay the baby boomers when they retire, this, you know, this rabbit going through the snake kind of thing, you know, of this demographic bulge, that Social Security trust fund is going to be exhausted in, say, 2042 or whatever, and the Social Security fund then will have income that will only be able to pay some 70-75% of benefits. Personal accounts, if you're going to take that out of that 12.4% that's being taken right now, it's going to mean there's actually even less money for payment of Social Security funds. So, I mean, even the president yesterday, in fact, it was somebody, a woman in the audience yesterday, asked the president, she said, and I quote, "I don't really understand. How is it that this new Social Security plan is going to fix that problem?" And he said, and I quote directly, he said, "Because the all which is on the table begins to address the big cost drivers, for example, how benefits are calculated, for example, is on the table. Whether or not benefits rise based on wage increases or price increases is a series of parts of the formula to being considered. When you couple that, those different cost drivers affecting those changes," and it gets rather incoherent because people don't talk the way that you can read it. But anyhow, the point that he makes is that private accounts are not going to do anything at all for the solvency problem. And if there is a crisis in Social Security, as he's claiming, that crisis is not that I don't have control over my Social Security money. That crisis is that Social Security won't be able to pay its obligations in 2042. What would you suggest we do to solve that solvency problem?
Well, I think, I mean, private accounts will not solve the problem. But one thing that I have heard, because those that choose to have the private account, their return will be higher on the 4%. And therefore, will still be able to stay above the safety net and basically lose a couple percentage points of the 8%. They're basically paying for the transition costs because they are getting a higher rate of return from the 4%. They're basically saying, because you're already getting more money on that, we're not going to give you all of the remaining 8%.
But that 4%,
you know, that's not the only thing that's going to solve it. They're also talking about raising the age from 67 to, you know, 68, 69 on when you can collect.
Right.
That, you know, benefits would have to be cut by 35%, or that payroll taxes would have to be increased by 50% if it was, you know, one or the other. But, I mean, there's going to have to be a combination of things. And like you said, also recalculating the wage, recalculating how women who don't work benefit. There are numerous things. It was a faulty system to begin with, so there's going to have to be a lot of changes.
Well, it's a faulty system that has never failed to pay a check in 70 years. What's wrong with that?
That at some point that money, or, you know, we're cashing checks that, you know, the government can't, you know, pay for. It's a faulty
Why
system
not?
In that money was in and out. I mean, you can't say, okay, we'll start paying you when you turn 65. I mean, if they would have collected money for, you know, 40 years and, you know, held on to it, which the government really doesn't have a good, you know, record of doing, of holding on to money, because they were starting to collect money and then pay it right out to people that were already over the retirement age.
Social Security's
that's what makes it faulty.
Social Security's worked just fine all these years. It's still working just fine.
But because of the baby boomer generation, we just don't have the same number of people.
Right.
Back in 82,
we saw that was coming. And once the baby boomers are all dead, it's going to go back to, you know, more you can pay as you go kind of a situation. And so they got together and Reagan signed off on this and said, okay, let's raise the Social Security tax and actually save more money than we're paying out from 82 till roughly 2020. And we'll create this trust fund. We'll create this surplus. The other question I have, when you do the math, Bush is saying that people get a 4% rate of return. And there was a piece about this in the Wall Street Journal, actually, last week, that you get a 4% return on your investments And therefore, people will do better than the roughly 3% that people are getting in the bond market right now. The Social Security is trust fund is invested in bonds right now, by and large. That'll be a great thing. But that assumes that the economy is growing at around a 4.5% annual rate to get that kind of a return. And if the economy were to grow at that rate, and then you simply recalculate how many Social Security taxes there would be, then the Social Security system never becomes deficient. It simply never becomes deficient. So if we take Bush's numbers that he gives and he says, okay, here is how much money you'll make with a private account, excuse me, and apply the same economic assumptions to those numbers to simply payroll taxes, there is no problem with Social Security. On the other hand, if you take the assumptions that he's making about when he says there's a crisis in 2042, that assumes that this three-year recession that we've been in is going to continue for the next 20 years. And so if you take those set of assumptions, that means that your rate of return on investments, even optimistically in the stock market, is going to be like 1.5%, 2%. So either way, it doesn't work.
Well, I mean, that's a good problem to have if you think that Social Security is going to continue to be solvent for the next, 50 or 100 years. I think that this president has had the forethought to think maybe I'm, in this office for a reason, and regardless of the fact that I'll be dead by the time Social Security, has a crisis, let's do something about it now.
Medicare is running out of money in a year and a half.
Well, then he should do something about that. I mean,
that's a real crisis.
They're
running out of money in a year and a half. I'm just a little, a little baffled by this thing, and it just seems to me like really what's going on is that the folks who are calling for privatization are trying to inculcate into the minds of young people in the United States that the free market and privatization will solve everything, and causing them not to realize that Social Security was never designed as a retirement program. It isn't a retirement program. It is an insurance program. More than a third of the beneficiaries of Social Security right now are widows, orphans, I mean literally orphans, kids whose parents have died. A friend of mine in New Mexico broke his neck. He's paralyzed from the waist, from the neck down. He's on Social Security. That's a third of all Social Security payments are being made to people who never paid into it.
None of that will be touched in any type of personal retirement account.
But it would have to be, or we're going to have to borrow over $2 trillion to fund it. And we're paying $180 billion this year in your taxes and mine just on the money that Reagan borrowed in the early 1980s so that 1984 he could make it look like a good economy and get himself reelected. We're going to have to spend a fortune on taxes to pay for the interest on that $2 trillion.
Well, this is a country that decided long ago that it wanted to take care of the disabled and the elderly, and at some point, we have to pay for it, and people have to decide who's better to handle my retirement, me or the government.
Yeah,
I think
good
that's
question.
What it comes down to.
Good question, and I think if you look at a lot of elderly people, they're going to get screwed. Lisa, stick around for a minute.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzle-dazzled them.
And welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour.
Lots of flash in it made them believe you were compassionate.
We're talking with Lisa DePasquale, who is the program director of the Claire Booth Luce Policy Institute in Herndon, Virginia, managing editor of The Right Report, therightreport.com, co-owner of Heatbags, heatbags.com. And Lisa, welcome back to the program. Lisa, just a couple of quick questions, and I've got a bunch of callers here who want to talk to you as well, if that's all right with you. In Argentina, when Argentina privatized their Social Security system, that's what caused that nation to go bankrupt, because they had to borrow so heavily in order to do it. Does that not give you pause, number one? And number two, if you look at, let's just look at, for example, health insurance. The Medicare program, here you are, the boring bureaucrats of the federal government. We have single-payer health care system in Medicare. And for every $100 that passes through the hands of Medicare, somewhere between $2 and $2.50 sticks to the fingers of the system. That is, that's the cost of administration for Medicare. For every $100 that passes through the private health insurance system in the United States, the for-profit private health insurance system in the United States, somewhere between $18 and $30 sticks to their fingers because they have to pay dividends to their stockholders. I mean, and I'm all in favor of free enterprise and capitalism and all that. I mean, don't get me wrong here, but they have to pay their dividends. They have to pay their multimillion-dollar salary to their CEO. They've got to pay for the corporate jets. They've got to pay for the headquarters. They've got to pay for the advertising. They've got to, you know, they have all these expenses that the bean counters in Washington who just get these nice, boring civil service job, you know, and don't have. And in 70 years, Social Security has never had a scandal, never had an embezzlement, never missed a check. And yet we see, you know, health insurance companies and other insurance companies around us going down in flames. How could you say that the government can't do a good job with handling Social Security, you know, in the face of these kinds of things?
Well, one thing that has come out is that the president has modeled his plan on the Thrift Savings Plan, which federal employees use today to manage their retirement savings. And basically they found that the fees that are paid in managing these accounts that are going to that are being invested into private their own private accounts is less than 0.1% of assets under management. So you know, it's certainly,
but the Thrift Savings Plan is heavily subsidized by the federal government. I mean, you couldn't, if you model Social Security after the Thrift Savings Plan, you'd have to go $4 or $5 trillion in debt.
Well, see, in a lot of the reports that have come out about how much the transition cost would be for personal retirement accounts, it all assumes that the 4% that's taking out would equal zero. So I'm not sure where your figures come from, but I know in the one where they
Congressional
said the
budget office
cost for this would be $8 trillion, they're assuming that that 4% would automatically equal zero.
Yeah, well, I'm just using the $2 trillion, the 10-year figure, not the you know, the infinite horizon number that Bush is using for his number. Lisa, let's take a couple calls. We've only got about 3 minutes here left. 1-866-889-8894. Ed in Shawnee, Kansas on the line. Hey, Ed.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great. What's up?
Well, I think that your guest is totally missing the point that Social Security is an insurance program, and that's the bottom line. This is.
So it's like I don't go to my car insurance company and say, "Hey, I didn't have an accident this year. Give me back my money."
Yeah, you don't do that, and you don't take your money and stick it in a personal account in case you may have an accident.
Because you'd be wiped out.
That's what they've done for healthcare, because now they found the healthcare insurance, you know, is a scam.
But
so they have healthcare accounts.
Well,
the healthcare personal accounts are a scam. I am a physician. I can tell you this as an actual fact. The personal healthcare accounts are fine for. I'm a fairly wealthy person. They're fine for me, but they are a scam for the average person.
And I'm not wealthy.
Now let's talk about.
But if you get hit with a $250,000, $500,000 medical bill, Lisa, you know your $6,000 health insurance savings are not going to do you much good.
They disappear.
But that's why people have catastrophic insurance.
Right. Well, that's the point, and that's the point that Ed is making, is that this is insurance. This isn't an investment program.
Well, I think it's easy to say that it's insurance, except for years people have been told and have continued to live that way that it's not insurance, that it is going to be your only income. That's why investment.
It's insurance against poverty.
Down and private savings has gone down because it was meant to be a three-pronged system, one with Social Security, with a private investments, or whether it's under the mattress or elsewhere, and then from a pension plan. It was only meant to be one-third of
savings, but
it's not that way anymore.
Radio.org.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
My daddy was a feather in the basement. My mom was an engineer. And I was born one dark green morning. Music coming in my ears.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you.
They call me Baby Driver.
Where blue states see red and where red states get the blues. Indeed. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. President Bush yesterday basically saying, well, let's, you know, to deal with the solvency problem, let's look at changing the way we pay out benefits. Change the rate. In other words, if it doesn't quite keep up with inflation, then, you know, over time, everything's well, right? Sounds good to me. Somehow I don't think so. Amy in San Diego's on the line. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I was just listening to your guest on there, and I heard her say people that make minimum wage could take that money and invest it. Is she for real? Does she honestly think people are making it on minimum wage and they wouldn't have to use that money?
Well, to give her credit, her point was that you have no choice with regard, if you're on minimum wage, you have no choice about paying into the Social Security Trust Fund. If in fact, Lisa's back on the line with us, and so we can just get her on. Lisa, Amy in San Diego's on the line. Amy, toss your point out again, and let's let Lisa respond to it.
Okay, I'm just saying that people that live on minimum wage can barely make it as it is if their paycheck got 4% bigger or whatever the amount is that Social Security would make their check bigger. They would have to spend it to live on because they're not making it now. There's no way those people could save it. I'm nowhere near minimum wage, and I live paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
The 4% is not going to their paycheck. It has to stay in the system. They won't be able to get it until they can get Social Security. It's just that they could control whether it goes in like a government bond or an index fund or something like that.
They won't even have the control of where it goes. They'll have specific funds that they can pick from, right? So they're still not in control of their money.
The system's perfect. Yeah, I never said the system was perfect. I mean, if it was up to me, then people would, be able to have control of all 12%, and they could even choose to invest if they wanted, or they could spend it as they get it.
Yeah.
But, that's not the society that we live in.
Amy, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Lisa, here we are, we're talking, Amy's point, I think, and what Amy was saying was, if this 4% that you're talking about is, if somebody's making minimum wage, they're barely getting by, they can't, they can't even afford health insurance. We have 45 million people in America with no health insurance, for example, they would rather use it for something other than putting in a retirement fund. But the reality is that the government is saying you have to put this in a retirement fund. This is mandatory. If you don't do it, we're going to send guys with guns to your
12%.
Door. Right. If you don't do it, we're going to send guys with guns to your door and make you do it. I mean, that's the bottom line. You just stop paying your taxes for a year or two, and that's what will happen. And so it sounds to me like what you're advocating is coerced, using the coercive power of government to force us to put money into the private sector. Am I missing something here?
And the plan would say you could keep all 12% in the Social Security system if you wanted to. It would just allow you to, rather than rely on all 12% of that, actually having ownership of 4% and putting it basically back into the economy rather than sending it back to Washington where it's going to go in and out. I mean, it's only 4%, and you could either stay in the system or you could have control of that 4%. If you're not comfortable with, your own choice as far as whether you wanted a government bond or, an index fund, then you can keep within the current system. But basically, it's just creating a cycle of wealth for those people that want to choose it. That 4% could then be passed on to their heirs, whenever they die. At that point, it could be used for anything, not just retirement.
So, Amy, where does the money come from to pay for my friend Michael in New Mexico who broke his neck? Where does the money come from to pay for the orphans? Where does the money come from to pay for those people who have outlived the actuarial tables, who set aside money in their private accounts on the assumption that they were going to die at the age of 77.8 or whatever the average life expectancy is, and they happen to live to 86? Where is that money going to come from?
I mean, that's why we're in, the problem that we're in, because people are living longer, which is great news. But, it is money that's coming from current workers. And I doubt that, any president, they don't call Social Security the third rail for nothing. I mean, if it's not coming in from Social Security revenues, it's going to come from the general fund. And also, my name's Lisa.
Lisa, did I call you Amy?
If you're talking to me or not.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Lisa. Yes. Keep me straight here. It's been a long day. Okay, let's move along. Let's take a few other phone calls here. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma on the line. Hey, Glenn.
Hi, Tom. These two things, Social Security and health care, are linked, and I don't think there would be this push for Social Security. It would be on Medicare, since it's going broke immediately, if trillions of taxpayer dollars were going to be funneled into Medicare the way they're going to be funneled into Social Security with this fix.
Yeah, the big difference between Medicare and Social Security And Lisa, you can address this if you wish, but it seems to me that the big difference between Medicare and Social Security is that Social Security is setting money aside, and Medicare is paying present expenses. And so the 10 largest donors to the Bush campaign in the last election cycle, all major banks and financial houses, and we're talking, you know, millions, tens of millions of dollars to the Republican Party as well, these large donors will not see much money if we were to privatize Medicare or fix Medicare. But they can see, yeah, okay, it's a 0.1%, or it's a very small percentage that they may make in management fees. But if we're talking trillions of dollars, that's billions that they could see at the end. And that's certainly worth, you know, paying off a few politicians with a few tens or hundreds of millions of dollars over the short term.
Well, I mean, many of the top 10 donors of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party tend to be the same people, you know, people just covering, you know, both bases. I mean, I'm not.
Actually, there's not. Over the last 10 years, there's been a real significant divergence between the two. They're very different folks these days. Just Lisa.
The Institute doesn't, I mean, we don't speak out about, you know, Medicare. I mean, generally we're not a group that talks about policy. We actually can't talk about legislation. So if there was something, you know, on Medicare, we couldn't even
talk
about
it. So why are you
it.
Into the Social Security thing?
Well, I was booked as talking about why the Rock the Vote people, because we're a youth group, why Rock the Vote is supporting Social Security versus why that doesn't correlate with the youth vote or with the youth view on Social Security.
Okay, so your point.
That's pretty much what we do.
Your point is the Rock the Vote people, my understanding of them, I don't know them, is the Rock the Vote people are advocating that what? That we shouldn't change Social Security?
They're advocating that there should not be any changes and that politicians are lying about the solvency of Social Security. I mean, they basically say, just like a lot of people that aren't against personal retirement or that are against personal retirement accounts, they say, you know, don't trust the government to tell you that it's going to run out. Instead, you know, trust the government. So, I mean, my view is just that these groups say that they're for a certain constituency like NAACP or, you know, National Organization for Women, but time and time again, the actual views of their groups differ from the agenda that group is advancing.
So really they're part of the great liberal conspiracy.
I didn't say it was a conspiracy. It just happens that they're a liberal organization. We're a conservative organization, but we don't claim to be otherwise.
Yeah. Isn't this really ultimately, when you get right down to it, isn't this really about the fact that the Bush administration and the Clinton administration before them and the George Herbert Walker Bush administration before them and the Reagan administration before them, and this all began in 82 with Reagan.
Don't go back any further because I wasn't born yet.
Okay. Well, I can't go back any further because we didn't create the Social Security Trust Fund until 1982. Before that, prior to that time, Social Security paid out based on the taxes that they brought in. And back in the late 70s, they looked at this and they saw all these baby boomers retiring, you know, after the year 2000, and they said, we're going to need more money than we'll be able to have, even with significant tax increases. So let's start saving some money. And so the Social Security Trust Fund came into being in the early 1980s as money that was going to be set aside. Al Gore was talking about the lockbox. I don't think anybody in America understood what he was talking about, but this is what it was, that it was money that should be set aside to pay out benefits to people when they retire. And the way that they did this was they raised rather dramatically the Social Security tax in 1982. Reagan signed off on this. And so there's this big pile of money, and it's a couple trillion dollars. And what has happened, and as I said, this is something that Bill Clinton did. I'm not being partisan about this. I consider them all villains in this regard. But what has happened is, for example, last year George Bush said, you know, our budget deficit was $513 billion or whatever it was. There was actually another $200 billion that came into the government in Social Security taxes that the Social Security Administration didn't have to pay out, because the baby boomers haven't started to retire yet. That money should have been invested in Treasury bills and just simply set aside. Instead, what happened was Bush borrowed that from Social Security, put it into the general fund, and then because it was intra-government borrowing, said, we don't have to include this in the amount of the deficit. So the real deficit was over $600 billion because we borrowed $200 billion from ourselves. And we've been doing this ever since Reagan. We have been borrowing out of this trust fund that we've been accumulating and putting that money into the general fund. So now you have a situation where the Social Security Trust Fund is supposed to have about $1.5 to $2 trillion sitting in it. And the only way that that money can be paid back is for general revenues, that is the income tax, to go up dramatically to pay that money back. And that's why everybody's doing this soft shoe shuffle here to avoid even talking about that, both Democrats and Republicans, in my opinion. What's your take on this?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree that, you know, it is something that has been done as far as borrowing from, you know, one department to another to, you know, go into the general fund so that money can be used for anything. And it's a problem that's not going to be solved, you know, anytime soon. And to me, one good aspect is that keep the money from going there in the first place.
Oh, I agree. So shouldn't we be talking? I mean, the two real crises that I see are, number one, the fact that our income tax system owes our Social Security tax system a couple of $1 trillion. And in order to pay that back, income taxes are going to have to go through the roof. Number one. And number two, that somehow 30 years from now, probably I'll be dead and you'll be retiring or whatever, 30 to 40 years from now, Social Security is not going to be able to pay 100% of benefits. It's only going to be able to pay 70% of benefits. Now, those both have to do with liquidity. George Bush has not given one specific suggestion that would solve that liquidity crisis, and neither of the Democrats for that matter. But Bush is the one who put this on the table and said, hey, it's a crisis. So, you know, what would you do to solve those two problems?
Well,
those are the real problems.
From my understanding, it will be my generation and probably at least another generation or two after that that will basically be giving up a portion of their 12%, whether, you know, it's all 8% or not. But if you, you know, did have ownership of the 4%, they believe that because of an increased rate of return on that 4%, it would be enough for you to live off that and give up your 8%, which would then pay for, you know, whatever repayment.
Right, but in that happy world.
Whether or not that's going to happen, who knows?
Yeah, well, see, the economic assumptions for that happy world, you know, assume a growth rate of 4%. Even during the roaring 90s, the annualized growth rate for the entire decade of the 90s was 3.2%. In other words,
well, people usually pay for longer than 10 years into Social Security.
Right, and exactly. And if you look at the entire 75-year history of Social Security, which includes the Great Depression, if you take all of those years and you average them out and you assume that the rate of growth of the economy for the next 75 years is going to be exactly what it was for the last 75 years, then there is no Social Security crisis. Social Security is 100%
funded. Do you
believe
that the rate of growth would increase if there was more money put back into the economy?
Well, it depends on how you put it back into the economy. If you're talking about putting it into the stock market, I think the stock market would go up. But if you're talking about putting people money into people's hands so they can buy things, then you're going to have more people starting businesses to provide them with products.
Well, the stock market isn't just like this, you know, planet somewhere. I mean, it's based, you know, it's
the stock market is basically a gambling board.
That hire people.
No, it's not. If you go out and Lisa, if you go out and you buy $100 worth of IBM stock, none of that money goes to IBM. That money goes to whoever used to own that IBM stock. The only time that you're putting money into corporate coffers when you buy stock is when you buy into an IPO, an initial offering. That's it. Otherwise, you're simply buying money from other people. So what will happen is that
the people that are selling get money.
Sure. Well, they're getting their money back out.
Business owners.
Right. But it's not helping. They may or may not be business owners. It's not helping the companies that you're investing in. That's the bottom line. And it seems to me that Bush, not just Bush, the Republicans and Democrats are looking at this situation and saying, hey, we've got a disaster coming because we're going to have to pay back a couple of $1 trillion out of the income tax fund back to the Social Security fund. And we don't want to do that. So let's fiddle with the system so that we can pretend that we never even stole that money, essentially. And you know, I mean, Clinton saying that he had balanced the budget, he hadn't. He was still borrowing from Social Security. Bush saying his budget deficit's only $400 billion. It's not. It's $600 billion. I mean, this is, as I said, these lies go all the way back to Reagan. And the bill is coming due. And so instead, they're trying to deflect us all with this conversation of, wouldn't you like to own some of your money? I think they're just playing, Lisa, with all respect, I think they're playing you for a sucker.
I mean, I, I know there are plenty of problems, and the fixes no one wants. No one wants to increase the retirement age. No one wants to pay more payroll tax. No one wants to cut a benefit. So, you know, it's kind of the personal retirement account is a sidebar, you know, perhaps to the overall problem. But
you know,
the root of it is correct. I mean, people should be able to have control over whether or not that money is continually put into the government. I mean, people don't believe that.
Well, and that's what we have.
Obviously, pay more than or can handle their money better than they can.
Well, actually, I believe the government can handle money better than I can. I mean, I look at the history of
Social
Security.
Well, that's why you're allowed to stay in the system if you would like.
They've done a fine job of that. We've only got about 30 seconds left. In fact, that's it. We've got a 5-minute break here and then a 2-minute wrap up. So, Lisa, thanks for sticking with us. I appreciate
sure.
it. Lisa DePasquale, she's an managing editor of The Right Report, therightreport.com. Corner of Heatbags, heatbags.com. Lisa, I appreciate your being with us
Thanks.
Today. 10 minutes before the hour, it's Tom Hartman.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lint.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Close your eyes, close the door. You don't have to worry anymore.
Yeah, George is going to save us all by giving our money to the corporate investors on Wall Street to fund his political campaigns. Everything's going to be just fine. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Lynn in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Lynn.
Hi. You know, she talked about how the only way to correct the insolvency was to lower benefits, and I thought that maybe you'd mention some of the several plans you had.
I was going to suggest that we eliminate the caps, and I mean that would simply solve the problem. I ran out of time, frankly.
Oh, okay, all right.
So, I mean, I wasn't trying to convince her. I mean, it was very clear. Became very clear to me that
she wasn't answering your questions directly,
you know,
and she had her mind made up.
Yeah, her job was to put her position out, and she wasn't here to learn mine. I mean, you know,
yeah.
That is certainly, and I think my listeners know my position well enough that I didn't feel the need to repeat it over and over again.
Well, that's true.
But
I guess I was trying to convince her, but you're right. She wouldn't have heard it anyway.
Yeah, it's a tragic shame. This is a piece I wrote for Common Dreams a couple of weeks ago, is about how I really think that this whole Social Security scam that Bush is running around the country doing is an attempt. I don't think he intends to win it. I don't think he really intends to make these changes. What he's trying to do is he's trying to convince young people that of the conservative philosophy, the conservative talking points, that, you know, anything government does is bad and evil, and anything corporations do is good and wonderful, and we should simply turn our lives over to corporations and trust them. And, you know, history tells us that when we do that, we're in deep trouble. Lynn, thanks for the call.
Yeah.
I got to move along.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Judy in Michigan on the line. Hey, Judy.
Yeah, well, make this quick because you got to go off the air in a couple minutes.
Yeah.
I'm a senior, but I've been on disability since the middle 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And if Bush is going to mess with Social Security and Medicare, that's just going to put the hurt to us.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And
because
he's not just going
to
mess with it.
I have secondary insurance every other month.
Yeah.
Because I try to go off of another HMO and pay the 20% that Medicare doesn't pay, and then I had to go into bankruptcy just so I could get secondary insurance.
Yeah, and now they're going to say, oh, you want to go into bankruptcy? Guess what? We've got a surprise for you.
Oh yeah, I mean they got all kinds of surprises. But Tom, back in the 70s, they said Social Security was going broke too.
Oh, I know. It was the main when George W. Bush was running for the House of Representatives in '76 in Texas. His main platform was that Social Security would be bankrupt within 20 years.
Oh, you'd probably be dead before then. I mean, I'm 62, almost 60. I mean, 63, almost 64 years old.
Yeah, and we had to wrap it at that, Judy. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. What thinking people do for fun.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program. Normally in the second hour of our program on this day of the week, we run a segment called Everything You Know Is Wrong, where we go a little deeper, a little beyond the average topics. Talk about things you didn't know, that you didn't know, that you needed to know, that you didn't even know that you didn't know about. And so we're going to do that right now. It's time for our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Could it be? Is it possible that that there could be murders and that are being covered up, or that let's let our guest Shanka Wakan, who is active with North Coast Earth First, indicates that he was an eyewitness to the death of David Gypsy Chain. Is that right?
That's correct.
Tell us what happened, Shanka.
Sure. Well, it was back in September 17th, 1998, and a group of us hiked up to the top of this ridge where Maxdam Corporation, based out of Houston, Texas, and Pacific Lumber Company, based out of Humboldt County, California, were logging illegally and clear-cutting on a very steep and unstable slope right above one of the California state parks out here, Grizzly Creek State Park.
What makes you suggest it was illegal what they were doing?
Well, a few things. First of all, it's marble murrelet nesting habitat. The marble murrelet is an endangered seabird that needs the old-growth redwoods and their big branches way up high to nest.
Right, but had some government agency determined this? I mean, was this placed off?
That's right. That's right. Every year there's a marble murrelet nesting season where the timber companies are not allowed to go into these areas and cause disruptions. They can maybe, do surveys and stuff, but they certainly are not supposed to have big machinery in there punching in roads before September 15th, which is the end of marble murrelet nesting season.
Right.
And that's, in fact, what they were doing, had done, so that by September 17th, 2 days later, not only did they have their road all the way up to the top of this ridge, but they had clear-cut almost an entire unit of one of their timber harvest plants, they call them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In addition, they had also started outside of their timber harvest plan boundary and worked their way in to the boundary. So they'd clear-cut some of the hillside illegally also. Mm-hmm. And even if it was legal, Earth First still would have the good reason to go out there, because they're still clear cutting on a steep and unstable slope, which unfortunately is legal but completely irresponsible.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So the lumber companies are out there, and you're asserting that they were out there illegally, or this was on the tail end of what you're saying was illegal activity. And then what happened?
Right. So a group of us. Seven of us went up to talk to the logger and just, have conversation with him, because a group of people had went to the California Department of Forestry the day before and had a protest out in front of their office to say, hey, come take a look at this spot. And the CDF agreed, said, okay, we'll have somebody out there tomorrow. So we went out there, one, to see if the CDF had been out there.
What's the CDF?
And two, to stall logging until the CDF could get out there if
Shanka,
they hadn't been out
Shanka,
there.
Shanka, what's a CDF?
Oh, the California Department of Forestry.
Okay, great.
Yeah. And so as soon as we approached the logger, he just became instantly irate and just started throwing stuff at us, sticks, rocks, anything he could find, and also threats. and where he said, and we caught him on videotape because we had two videographers who were hiding behind a tree. The logger didn't know that they were there. And he actually says on the tape, he says, get out of here, or I'll make sure I got a tree coming your way.
Mm-hmm.
Very clearly on the tape. And then later on, he also says he wished he had his pistol, said he wished he, that he was going to start packing it out in the woods with him from then on. And then he says to his logging partner, give me my saw, I'm going to start falling trees into the draw, which is a shallow ravine, and we are directly on the other side of that. And so he did exactly what he said, and he, you know, grabbed his chainsaw, and he started falling trees directly at us. And we tried to approach him one more time, you know, because you don't want to just run away from a situation like that, because, you know, if you put it in their minds that these kind of threats and this kind of behavior is effective, then they're just going to keep doing it.
But this guy is, he's not the head of the lumber company. He's not a decision maker. He's just a guy with a chainsaw. I mean, from his point of view, and I'm assuming that you can, at some level, you can empathize with him. You're threatening his paycheck. He's just, you know, he's doing what he's paid to do. Right.
Yeah, well, you know, at most we'd be stalling him for a little while until the police got there. See, that's kind of the normal procedure. It's, you know, the protesters show up in the woods. The logger has, you know, normally would have to stop logging and then, you know, get on his radio, call a supervisor. Supervisor calls the police. The police come out, make the arrest. You know, we get arrested, do our media. The point gets made.
So then what you're doing is, what you would be doing was illegal. Because you're the ones who get arrested, not the loggers.
Right, which there's definitely a problem with that, too, you know, is that we're automatically the ones that are assumed to be wrong, when ideally, really, they would bring somebody out, you know, an agency representative out and make an actual determination. Are the citizens right, or is the logging company right?
Right.
You know, so ideally it wouldn't always be that we get arrested, but that's how it's been for the past, you know, 20 years here.
Sure.
And that's, you know.
Okay, so this guy's felling trees towards you guys, and what happens?
Right, and so finally we go and try and, you know, talk to him one last time, and we're going to call it a day after that, and we step out into this clearing, and, you know, we hollered out, gave him a chance to not fall that last tree. We heard him pound the wedge out anyway, you know, which is the wedge cut that they make in the tree.
Right.
And that's one of the last things they do before the tree falls.
Mm-hmm.
So he had that last opportunity to not fall that tree in our direction, but he did. And it came down, and the whole group of us just barely got out of the way except for Gypsy. And Gypsy was killed. You know, that tree came down just above him, broke, rolled down maybe 10 feet, and hit him right in the head and killed him instantly.
Wow.
And
the response to this, now if you guys were showing up there expecting to get arrested, as you indicated, then I mean, who, well, without going on to that, first of all, there's this story here that I have. It's something, there's a slap suit going on, and you've got the Humboldt County District Attorney. You know, what was the response of this group? Actually, before we go any farther, Joaquin, do you mind if we take some calls from some folks in Humboldt County?
That'd be great.
Okay. Here is Elaine in Humboldt County. Hey, Elaine, what's up?
Well, Tom, that is a kind of an old case, and it's kind of as he has described it, but the district attorney here has more or less turned the tables on him, and I think it's going to go our way. Hurlbut and the Pacific Lumber Company.
Well,
are
wait
not
a second, wait a second,
be...
Elaine. Who is our? I mean, it's going to go which way?
Well, I think it's going to go the way of the people. I don't think Hurlbut and Pacific Lumber are going to win on this.
Okay, so by the people, you mean the folks who are suggesting that the lumber
just
company
the general public that owns land in Humboldt County.
Yeah. So
it has been a terrible thing that's happened up here over the years.
Yeah. So this is public property that this logging was going on?
Well,
no.
I don't know about that.
No. It was private property?
Yeah, it's considered private property.
I see. Okay. All right.
One other thing, Tom, I would like to say in regard to the Social Security.
Sure, Elaine.
I, too, draw railroad retirement, not Social Security. You either get one or the other.
Right.
Because on my husband's name. But I worked for 30-some years, and I paid Social Security all that time. Where'd that money go?
Well, it's just like with insurance. I mean, I've paid car insurance for probably 40 years now, and I'll probably I'll never see any of it. I mean, that's how insurance works. It protects us from catastrophes.
What I'm trying to say is that when we're drawing it on our spouse, doesn't mean that we haven't earned it.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
Elaine, Elaine, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. So as Elaine says, Walken, this is an older story. But what's the recent part to it? I've got the March 17th, 2005 criminal complaint of homicide was filed. This was just a few weeks ago.
That's right.
Okay.
Our current district attorney, Paul Gallegos. Well, let me backtrack just a minute. Directly after Gypsy was killed, what was even, as equally horrifying was to see the cover-up by the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department. They did their little Mickey Mouse investigation. When we were interviewed, I felt that the interview was very hostile towards us by the homicide detective, the Humboldt County homicide detective, Juan Freeman. And when you read the transcripts, which came out later in a wrongful death civil suit brought by Gypsy's family, it's very obvious from the transcripts how splendid the investigation was.
These guys have felt that hey, you were the instigators. I mean, you showed up, you antagonized this guy, and he lost it, obviously.
Right, and that's their line of reasoning. But the have the right to civil disobedience in this country. We have the right to do nonviolent civil disobedience without being killed, without being assaulted and battered.
Yeah, this gets to the issue of what's more important, property rights or human rights, and that's a larger issue.
Which seems like it would be obvious.
Sure.
Obviously, if somebody walks across your yard, you don't have the right to shoot them.
Right, unless you think that they represent a threat to you. Yeah,
right. There was no breaking and entering or anything like that involved. We're just walking up to have a conversation.
Okay.
And the thing is that Pacific Lumber knows that these protests are just a part of life in Humboldt County. They've been going on since 1985. We're 20 years later. By now, they should have a clear policy of how to deal with these kind of situations. And
right.
Again,
it just makes sense. We're talking with Walken. Shunka Wakan in Humboldt County. Lloyd in Humboldt County is on the line. Lloyd, we've only got about a minute left. What's on your mind?
Well, I've lived in Humboldt County all my life and worked in several industries here. Most of the people that come in and protest, number one, aren't employed and don't even pay taxes, and they cost the local government thousands in taxes with their activity, and being on private property is not really a legal protest. It's not public property. They have no business there.
So, Walken, what's your response? We've got about 15 seconds.
Well, it's civil disobedience. Disobedience, you do break small laws to confront larger crimes that are being committed. These are Federal Endangered Species and Clean Water Act.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it at that. We're out of time, but I appreciate it. Lloyd, thanks for the call. Shauna Wonkon, thank you very much for being with us today and sharing this story. It's fascinating. I appreciate it. 20 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman with you.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small...
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
When sundown pales the sky, I want to hide a while behind your smile. And everywhere I look, your eyes would find.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It sounds like, there's two sides to every story sort of thing. And I'm my personal sentiments are generally with folks who are trying to preserve the land and protect species and things like that. And I think the larger point here is that as resources become more and more scarce, as the United States becomes more and more poor, I mean, we have, under the economic policies of Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush, these last 25 years of insane international trade policies, domestic policies, tax cuts for the rich, borrow from our children, out of control military spending. As a consequence of all these years of this insane behavior, we are going to see increasingly the confrontation between those who are trying to harvest our resources, to put it nicely, or make a quick buck off our resources, to put it not nicely, or whatever, however you want to characterize it, you're going to see, or simply meet the demand of the marketplace for our resources. You're going to see more and more of a collision between those people who are doing that kind of work and the people who are trying to protect our resources. We're going to see this with water. I predict in the next 5 years here in the United States, we're going to start seeing water wars going on. We're going to start seeing it with croplands, and increasingly we're going to see it with forest land. And these are issues that we need to be paying attention to. We need to be planning for. We need to be talking about. We need to have a discourse, a dialogue in the public arena about these kinds of topics. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number, and it is time for our report from Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, how are you?
I am great. What's up?
Well, we had the unveiling of the WMD Commission's report this morning. The president spoke in the old executive office building, was flanked by the two chairs of the report, Judge Silberman and former Senator Chuck Robb. This is a commission on the intelligence capabilities of the United States regarding weapons of mass destruction. That's what it's called.
Right.
I have a 40, 50-page summary here. The actual report is a book. I have it. It's about 600 pages. And it is scathing in terms of the intelligence capabilities, how things are set up. It did not talk about, and that they were very clear that they did not get into the politics of this, whether or not intelligence might have been twisted to reach certain conclusions. But they do say that without any doubt, basically, things are a mess, and they make 74 recommendations for change, 51 of which surround the new director of national intelligence.
And if things are so bad, and if with regard to intelligence, and if our fearless leader had any sense of that, wouldn't it have made sense to pay attention to Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei, who are professional lookers of, you know, professionals who've spent their lives and their intellect, and they've learned how to look for weapons of mass destruction, and they're traveling all over Iraq saying, we don't see anything, there's nothing here. And Rumsfeld says, oh, no, we know where they are. They're just in this triangle just above Baghdad. They say, cool, give us the satellite coordinates. We'll do a spring. We'll spring a surprise on them. We'll find them. And, oh, no, we can't give you that. We've got to wait until the bombing starts. And it's like, this is why Europe was looking at us going, why don't you give these guys another couple of weeks? Why don't you tell them where the weapons are? And, you know, prove it to the world and we'll be with you. And we didn't. We never did that. That's what it's. I'm going off on a rant. Anyhow, Victoria, we got 30 seconds. What else happened?
That was pretty much it. The president also spoke about Terry Schiavo's death, as you know. And frankly, those are the only two issues that anyone in Washington is talking about today.
Yeah, interesting. And the intelligence report, is it? Do you think the Porter Goss is going to do anything with this, or is this just going to be an excuse for more single party rule within the CIA, more slicing off the heads of Democrats?
Changes will be made.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
How far they'll reach, I don't know. But certainly, this commission feels that changes need to be far reaching.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Victoria Jones. I appreciate the report.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you with the Talk Radio News Service. 29 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Program, where we state the facts, connect the dots, follow the money, lay it on the line, and make the case for democracy in America.
Visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Here's the story of a corporation that has newspapers in every place you go. It also owns a couple cable stations, a movie studio.
A story about a corporation.
And there was another corporation that controlled all access to the internet.
And a great merger they had. Welcome to the program. It's Tom Hartman with you, 26 minutes before the hour. I neglected to mention, and I certainly should have, the Earth First folks, the complaint you can find that we were talking about when we were talking with Shunka is on www.northcoastearthfirst.org. All one word, northcoastearthfirst, F-I-R-S-T.org. And, you know, about they're filing this criminal complaint of homicide against a corporation, apparently a couple of corporations, for the murder of David Gypsy Chain. And they're reaching out to folks right now saying that they need some help in trying to get the Paul Gallegos, the district attorney and whatnot, to get involved with this. And if Paul is listening, he wants to call in and share his side of the story with us. Welcome to do that. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Alice in California on the line. Hey, Alice.
Yeah, Tom. From all that George Bush has done so far, I have to believe that saving Social Security for the people is the furthest thing from his mind.
Well, I agree with you. I think he's on and the one hand.
You are right on, Tom.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Alice.
Okay, good luck.
I appreciate it. Thanks, and thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Xavier in Santa Cruz, California on the line. Hey, Xavier, it's California Day, I guess. We're getting a lot of calls from the West Coast.
Yeah, well, my main point was about Social Security, but first I want to thank you for having the fellow on from Earth First. That was a really sad thing that happened to Gypsy, and I was involved with Headwaters up around that time. It was really sad.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, just briefly also on that, people like Tom DeLay, you know, these people break the law all the time, and whenever, I think direct action does have a place in society when the other side is breaking the law all the time, we need to kind of push the envelope a little bit too.
Well, this is the debate we've been having in our society since the late 1700s, and probably the most articulate thinker on it was Henry David Thoreau.
Yeah.
But in any case, we need not discuss the philosophy, I suppose, of direct action. But
I want to get on to that Social Security thing real quick.
Sure.
Quick point.
Sure.
You know, I'm going to play devil's advocate here again and
go
put on my libertarian hat.
Yep.
Only in the sense that I think that it advances our cause more. And I hear a lot of people talking about raising the cap. And it's my understanding that Social Security is an insurance, not an investment in the traditional sense.
That's right.
And if you go out and buy car insurance, you don't pay more for your insurance if you have more income.
Not true.
It isn't. Well, if you buy a more expensive car.
That's right. If I'm insuring a Hummer, it's going to cost a whole lot more than if I'm insuring a Toyota Prius.
But you get the same health care regardless of whether you're rich or poor, I think, through the money that you get back is roughly the same, isn't it?
Well, with a single-payer health care system, the more you're making if you have a progressive taxation system or even a flat tax,
I think the guy was running against Rick Santorum. He came up with this idea of raising the minimum wage.
Right.
And I think that's a much better – all I'm trying to do here is reduce arguments to make it more palatable for people in upper incomes. That's all I'm trying to do is point that out.
Well, you know, here's my that's fine, but here's my response to people in the upper incomes is pay your share of taxes, please.
I mean, okay.
You know, if somebody's making $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year and you know, life is not easy at those income levels in the United States anymore, particularly in some of the urban areas, if they're making that and they're having to pay 12% of their income for Social Security taxes to support the Social Security system, why isn't somebody who makes $1 million a year, why aren't George Bush's friends paying also 12% of Social Security into the Social Security fund? And they're not. You know, they're paying 1%, a half a percent, a quarter of a percent into it because they're only paying on the first $80,000 they earn. Why not pay on everything they earn?
Okay. Well, I just made my point. I would be okay with raising it somewhat, but I think that the paradigm of raising the the minimum wage to a livable wage, I think, would help out a lot.
Too. I think that's a great suggestion, and I also love the suggestion that somebody had emailed me yesterday that I shared on the air. I think it was Sandy. I don't remember his last name. Exempting the first $20,000 of income from any payment of FICA and eliminating the cap. And that way, anybody who makes $100,000 or less is going to get a tax cut in terms of FICA taxes, payroll taxes, and anybody who makes over $100,000 is suddenly going to start paying into the payroll tax system, and they haven't been up to this point, and therefore I would say they've been getting a free ride. And hey, the free ride is over, guys.
Yeah, okay. Well, that sounds good, too.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks, Tom.
Okay, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you, Xavier. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jake in Humboldt County. Hey, Jake.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's up?
Well, you know, I've lived in Humboldt County for many years, and you know, I heard that guy, Paul Gagos, on the radio, and you know, he promised that he'd reopen that gypsy investigation when he was running. And, you know, ever since he's been in office, he hasn't done that. You know, I think that's really dirty, you know, to use a dead man's name in your campaign and then to not follow through.
Yeah, well, I would suggest that you contact him and you contact your elected representatives and you make some noise about it. I mean, if that's real, and I'm assuming that it is, although I don't have the, you know, I'm not the independent arbiter of the facts here. And if, you know, if he made that promise during his campaign and he hasn't followed through on it, hold his feet to the fire. And you know, there's a lot of ways to do that. Calling a national radio show is one you just did. Write letters to the editor of the local newspaper. Put up flyers. You know, talk to your friends and you know and contact all of your elected officials from your local city councilman all the way up to your United States senators. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, on the line. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Oh, and by the way, Roy, before you get going, let me just tell Jake, who just called, the telephone number if you want to speak with your congressman or both of your senators, and I would recommend you call all three. The toll-free number to call your member of the United States Senate or the U.S. House of Representatives, toll-free, is 1-877-SOB-U, the letter U, S-O-B. 1-877-SOB-U-S-O-B. That gets you to the switchboard at the Capitol, and it's toll-free. Now, your turn, Roy.
What a beautiful phone number.
I know. I would love to know the history of that.
Pardon me?
I'd love to know the history of that.
I would, too. Three days ago, I went down to see Heather Wilson do a, quote, town hall meeting.
And Heather Wilson is?
As a Republican, neocon, in Pete Domenici's pocket out here in New Mexico. Unfortunately, she's my rep.
She's your member of the United States Congress.
Right.
Okay.
Unlike Tom Udall, who is my neighboring congressional rep, she didn't take any live questions. She took four or five written questions that her campaign staff must have written.
Right.
And it was a farce. It was a waste of time. The drug companies had their, and the HMOs and the insurance companies had their booths out front. And it was billed as a town hall meeting, and she talked for 30 or 40 minutes, took three or four, well, like I said, they were all written questions. But that was the bad news. The good news was last night we had our county ward meetings.
Uh-huh.
And as I told you a few days ago, we took 11 of 14 precinct seats or delegate seats in our four precincts out in my neighborhood. We ended up last night on a scale of 1 to 10. If the old line had been at, if we went into it and the situation was at about a 3, being very negative, we probably got it up to a 6 or a 7 last night.
That's great.
We lost a couple 3 battles. We had a couple 3 battles that we had prearranged not to have,
mm-hmm.
so that we had some juice with the new folks that were coming in. We had the new chair and vice chair were the old-timers, or were semi-old-timers, but the old-timers saw the writing on the wall and were leaving.
Yeah.
So we got with the new folks that wanted the thing and said, we can run our own candidate, but we're willing to go ahead and throw our support behind you for a couple years as long as you start paying attention.
Yeah. To our
issues, we basically move things again. You know, if it was a on a scale of 1 to 10, we moved it from probably about a 3 to a 6 or a 7.
Yeah, this is marvelous.
Everything we wanted.
But
it was building coalitions.
Yeah, exactly. That's democracy in America. And
building
that's
the bunch,
marvelous.
And it was fun. And again, the main reason that I keep talking about this, Tom, is I just want to encourage people to get out and do it.
Yeah. And I got to say, speaking of the town...
hard, but it's fun.
Yeah. And speaking of the town hall meetings, it's interesting that Heather Wilson took only written questions and did this whole scripted thing. I've been here in Vermont to several events where Bernie Sanders did town hall meetings. I mean, he does these things a couple times a week all around. I mean, all year long. He's where, you know, anybody who will invite
right.
him, Bernie shows up. And I've been to three of them, I think, in the last year and a half or so, and one by accident and two by intent. And Bernie gets up and he gives his little 20-minute rant, you know, whatever it's about, the topic du jour, and then he throws it open to questions, and he stays there until the last question is answered. I mean, one night we were there for 3.5 hours, and there was a number of people who stood up and just absolutely gave him hell. And, you know,
Tom Udall, the day before Heather's, had one here. Unfortunately, you know, just with work pressure, I couldn't go.
Yeah.
But he opened it, you know, again, he did his thing. He said, now I've only got another 45 minutes, but get in line and, you know,
yep.
whatever. And he ended up staying about 20 minutes after the time frame that he had preset.
Right.
But it was wide open.
Right.
Was, you know,
right.
Don't censor this stuff.
Yeah, that's how democracy is supposed to work. And I was so pleased and proud to see Bernie doing that and taking questions from conservatives or people who disagreed with him. And sometimes it was, you know, why isn't my pothole filled? And sometimes it was, hey, I completely disagree with you on this. And he respectfully listened to everybody, and he didn't back down. I mean, you know, he'd say, okay, this is my position, this is what I'm going to do. And, you know, sometimes we disagree on things. But it was an honest, open, right out there discussion. It was just marvelous. And so
in Wilson's pre-remarks, in her opening remarks, it was strictly talking points. Talking points, except that she wanted to step back from Bush a little bit.
Well,
on the Social Security thing.
Yeah, you know, the reason for this.
But she didn't do it very hard.
Yeah, the reason for this, Roy, is the reason why Republicans are reverting to talking points, and conservative Democrats as well, the Joe Liebermans of the world, are reverting to talking points, is because they don't have the facts on their side any longer. They don't even have philosophy on their side. So many of them have just sold out to large corporate interests. And without their talking points, they got nothing to say.
Yeah,
I mean,
and one other point: when Bush was out here 2 weeks ago, or a week and a half ago,
yeah,
he was at the Kiva Auditorium, and the headlines at the Los Alamos paper, or not in the headlines, but in the lead opening paragraph of the news reports, was over 1,000 people gave Bush a rousing ovation or whatever.
Oh, that's so strange because that was the lead paragraph in a news story that I read today in the newspaper,
and. The thing is that the Kiva Auditorium where he was speaking seats 2,600 people.
Oh, wow. yes.
And the local talk show, right-wing talk show host, who took off that day to be down there, and he got to meet the Menachie, and all this was so nice.
Right.
He said it was kind of interesting just watching the logistics of them getting the crowd arranged and getting them all settled in.
Yeah, it's all about appearances. Roy, I got to move along. I appreciate the call.
Have a good one. Thanks.
Thanks, you too. Good to hear from you. It's so much these days all about appearances among these politicians, and we need to be holding them to account and saying, you know, we'd like to have an actual conversation with you. And it's only going to happen when folks like you and I start standing up and saying so. Ed in San Juan, California on the line. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom. One serious question.
Yes, sir.
If we raise the minimum wage, won't that also hurt a lot of people at the bottom rungs who are relying on food stamps and stuff like that? Because they'll be knocked off those rolls.
There, you would have to recalibrate everything.
Well, that would be part of it then. But just raising the minimum wage would hurt more people by going up a few dollars because they'll knock them off. Let's say it's $950. If they make $951, they've lost food stamps.
Right, and that's why I said you have to recalibrate that, because there are some people who are getting food stamps because they're disabled, and
absolutely.
Minimum wage is going to have no effect on them. There are some people who are getting food stamps because they simply can't find a job, and they genuinely live in an area where there's no jobs to be had. It would have no effect on them. On the other hand, if somebody right now earning $5.15 an hour qualifies for food stamps, and those food stamps make up the equivalent of, let's say, 40 cents an hour in a paycheck, and we give them a minimum wage increase of 40 cents an hour, they're right back where they, but they lose their food stamps. They're right back where they started.
I'd say
they're not worse off, because now they don't have to deal with the bureaucracy of getting the food stamps, so they have a little more time. But the point is that,
it's not that I want food stamps. Don't get me wrong.
No. The point is that you would have to make the increase in the minimum wage meaningful. I mean, it would have to be significant and meaningful, so that there would no longer be a need for food stamps. The bottom line with regard to food stamps is that we as a society decided some time ago that we just didn't think it was appropriate that there be starving or hungry people among us.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, I don't think that you can build an argument against – in fact, I know you can't build an argument against – raising the minimum wage simply by saying, therefore, it's going to confuse the social safety net. What you do is you reconfigure the social safety net to provide for that.
I never hear anybody mention that.
Well, you just did. You just did. Ed, I got to move along. Nick in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Fine.
Oh, great. I heard Shunka talking on the radio about the DA and the gypsy case, And I just wanted to say that, the company used these climbers, these guys that climb up in the trees and they pull these kids out of the trees. And these guys, they're the wife beaters,
Yeah. Nick, I'm sorry, we're out of time. I'm not going there, calling people names. 10 minutes before the hour, it's a Tom Hartman program.
Workers Independent News, I'm Vinny Lombardo in Santa Cruz, California.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's close to town.
Dedicate that song to George W. Bush. Closing time. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 5.5 minutes before the top of the hour, before the end of today's program, actually. And I want to thank Ira for line producing this program and Luis for producing the whole show and all the folks in the chat room for showing up. And Small Dog Electronics and EcoWine.com, the organic wine company. Small Dog is 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS, by the way, and DemocraticMatch.com. Which is democraticmatch.com, for sponsoring the program, keeping us going here. 5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, and James in California on the line. Hey, James, what's on your mind today?
Well, as far as the minimum wage goes, California had an increase in minimum wage.
I'm sorry? James, first of all, I need you to speak a little louder. I didn't understand what you were saying.
I'm sorry. California a few years ago had a raise in the minimum wage, and all the everything from the price of fuel to the price of bread and eggs started to go up within 90 days before the wage, and people who were actually living on less and weren't employed were hurt by that.
Well, actually, James, if you go back, and there's no shortage, there's dozens of folks who've documented this quite well. If you go back all the way to the 1930s, when the minimum wage was first put into place, every year that the minimum wage was actually increased, employment went up and inflation went down. Because what happens is you increase the minimum wage and you are injecting more money into the local economy. So people are buying more things, which is helping business. And you're creating more demand. And so it's just good for the economy. Increasing the minimum wage ultimately is good for the economy.
Well, yes, I was just saying people that are working at the lower levels, everything that they need to survive goes up in price.
It does not go up in price as much as their pay does, and that's the important thing. Here, consider these statistics. In 1957, there was a minimum wage increase The big minimum wage increases were in 57, 63, and 96, okay? In 57, the inflation rate was 3.38%. They raised the minimum wage at the end of that year. The next year, inflation rate went down to 2.98%. 1959, it went down to half of 1%. In 1960, it was 1.72%. So you saw a slow, rather rapid and sustained decline in the inflation rate. In 1963, the inflation rate was 1.10%. They increased the minimum wage. In 1964, it was 1.37% inflation. 1965, inflation 1.62. No effect. 1996 was the last time we had a significant increase. In fact, it was the last time we had any increase in the minimum wage. And in 1996, the inflation rate was 2.96% nationwide. It raised the minimum wage nationwide, and the next year that inflation rate dropped from 2.96% annually down to 2.35%. The year after that, it went to 1.51%. That's 1998. And in 1999, it was down to 2.21%. Every single time since the minimum wage was first introduced that it gets increased, inflation goes down, economic activity goes up, and yes, you might be paying 4 or 5 cents more for a loaf of bread at the store because he's got to pay the clerk an extra, 50 cents an hour or something. But that is small compared to the extra money that you have in your pocket because the minimum wage went up. And the reason for that is because the cost of goods and services is not 100% labor. If it was 100% labor, your argument would make sense, but it's not. Typically, the labor cost in any product you buy is anywhere from 5 to 35%. So you don't hurt people when you raise the minimum wage. You help them. I appreciate your calling and making the point, though, James. It's an important one. A lot of people believe that mythology, and it's just that. It's a mythology. So that wraps up our program here. Thank you so much for being with us. The Life Support System for Democracy in America, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.